This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. Tom Waits has just released a new album called Bad as Me. It's his first studio recording of all new music in 7 years, and features guest performances from musicians like Mark Rebo, David Hidalgo, and Keith Richards, who sings on one track. We'll hear that one in a bit. Before we get to Terry's interview with Tom Waits, let's listen to the song Chicago. It's the opening track on Bad as Me, and was co-written by Tom Waits and Kathleen Brennan, who has been his songwriting partner and wife since 1980.
This is our planet here, but it won't grow. We won't have to say goodbye if we all go. Maybe things will be better in Chicago. Leave all we've ever known for a place we've never seen. Maybe things will be better in Chicago. Well, it's brave for us to stay, even braver to go. Wherever she goes, I go. Maybe things will be better in Chicago.
Tom Waits, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love the new album.
Oh, thanks, Terry.
So you're talking to us from your studio, recording studio. What's different from about your studio from anybody else's studio? Are there certain customized things for your particular needs?
Used to be an old school, has high ceilings and wood floors. We call it Rabbit Foot Studios. And what's different about it? Big empty rooms. Every room sounds different. There's still photographs up on the wall of all the kids who went to school here. And I never had a place of my own to work before. So it was always, you come into the studio and you know there's a band before you and you have to pack up at the end of your session because there's a band behind you. And you have to photograph the board so that no one will change your settings. And now it's my own rig. It's my own trailer, you know.
Why don't we hear another song? We could play Back in the Crowd, is a very like Mexican-flavored ballad. And it opens almost like Spanish Harlem, song.
Well, that is called Spanish Tinge, that genre of music, this tempo, this beat. It does have a lot in common with Spanish Harlem and a myriad of other songs. Of course, it's missing the castanets. That was fun to do.
I remember you saying that when you were growing up, you grew up near the Mexican border, and your father listened to exclusively Mexican radio stations where they spoke in Spanish, and you got introduced to a lot of, Mexican music that way and Spanish music that way.
Sure, yeah.
So do you feel like that is really embedded in you musically?
It has to be. Most of us have the residue of thousands of songs in our ears that I think if you wind up songwriting, I think you're mostly smoking the residue of all that material that you've absorbed over time.
Did the Mexican radio stations sound thrilling in a way because they were coming from another country in another language? I mean, one of the great things about, like, when radio was the only way of hearing a lot of music, you would try to get pull in stations from far away, and the further you could go, the more kind of special and mysterious it all started to sound to you. Did you have that reaction to the Mexican stations?
Well, my dad did not recommend us listening to anything but that. for some reason, he thought that was, everything else was really unimportant. We had to speak Spanish at the dinner table and all that. So
you had to speak Spanish at the dinner table?
Oh, yeah.
But he wasn't Spanish, right?
No, my dad was from Texas. But he grew up around the orange groves in Laverne, Pomona. And, you know, ate with the workers in the field and learned their songs. And then when he was college age, it just seemed the most appropriate thing for him to be doing would be something that incorporated his love of the language and the culture. So he became a Spanish teacher. And
When I
went to restaurants with my dad as a kid, when the mariachis would come to the table, he knew all the songs, and they were more interested in him. And he would suggest songs and was paying for them to play more and more songs. And by the end of the meal, he would usually get up and leave with them and go to the next gig with them. And we would find our way back to the hotel on our own.
That's funny.
Can you imagine that?
So one more question before we hear Back in the Crowd, and you'll probably think I'm crazy, but were you thinking about Elvis a little bit when you were singing this?
Oh, I think about Elvis all the time. But I think I probably was thinking about Elvis. You know, Elvis and Jim Reeves, too.
Mm-hmm.
My wife, you know, I'm the other half of what I consider to be a really great songwriting team, which means that we argue a lot, you know, about what a song can be, should be, what it'll be if you do this to it, you know. So we discuss all these facets, and she's a great, I don't know, Amelia Earhart and Jane Goodall and Ariel Durant and Joan Jett all rolled into one. She's really great to work with. And I feel sometimes like I have a map in my pocket that folds up, and I pull it out, and it's bigger than the table. And there's 1,000 places to go.
So you said you sometimes argue about songs, like what the song should
yeah.
be. So what was the argument in Back in the Crowd? What was one of the arguments?
Oh, she probably wanted it to be maybe more elaborate. Don't be afraid of it. Maybe sing it again, or maybe she said, don't sing it again. But, you know, we argue about everything, the cover. The cover originally for the record was going to be me wearing a house dress, standing in a boat with four other ladies holding an umbrella in, like, 1890. She said, no, you can't. You know, it's a colorful record, and it needs to have some rhythm and some life to it.
So let's hear Back in the Crowd, which was co-written by my guest Tom Waits and his wife Kathleen Brennan, and this is from his album Bad as Me.
You don't want these arms to hold you. Want these lips to kiss me. If you found someone new, put me back in the crowd. Put the sun behind the clouds, put me back in the crowd. There's a battle going on between the and the grave. And if you don't want my love, don't make me stay.
That's Tom Waits from his new album, Bad as Me, and the song is Back in the Crowd. And he co-wrote all the songs on this album with his wife, Kathleen Brennan. Now, the next track I want to play from it is called Talking at the Same Time.
All right.
And when I first heard this, I was listening to it in advance. I didn't have any liner notes or personnel or anything.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm listening to this track, and I'm thinking, Oh, it's a guest artist singing. Now, I know you sing in different voices, but it just kind of threw me at first because it's not the voice most associated with you. Would you consider this a falsetto?
Oh, no question about it, yeah. It's limited, my falsetto, but I...
So did you write this for your falsetto? Like, what came first, the song and deciding it should be falsetto or wanting to sing in falsetto and writing the song for it?
I don't know. It was a completely different song leading up to when we did it. And the night before, I decided I would do it as a lonely blues with those horns echoing back and forth. I don't know. It just sometimes the song, the magnetism of the song is impossible to ignore, and it demands that it be sung in a certain way. And that's really your job as an interpreter, to discover what is the way in. Is this spoken word? Do I growl this? Do I eliminate all my growl and try and do it like a younger man? Or, you know, what does the song need? It's more like an actor.
Well, it's interesting that first you write it and then you interpret it, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're a writer-director and star.
Well, let's hear it. This is okay. Talking at the Same Time by my guest, Tom Waits. And here it is.
Get a job, save your money, listen to change. Everybody knows umbrellas cost more in the rain. And all the news is bad. Is there any other kind? And everybody's talking at the same time. And everybody's talking.
Songs about death on the new album. And
oh, about death. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, like one is explicitly about death, and one of them is kind of a metaphor for death called Last Leaf.
Yeah.
And,
well, I don't know. You could say it's a metaphor for death, or you could say it's really a song about the last leaf on a tree, you know, because I did see a tree out in my yard that had one leaf left on it.
Oh, really?
And I looked at that leaf and I said, "Hang on, buddy. If you hang on, you can make it to the next season. If you can make it to the next one, you might be here next year, greeting all the new ones. Hang on, bud." I remember saying that to myself, like I was talking to a cat, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, my wife said, "Get Keith to sing on that."
Yeah, this is Keith Richards, who's featured on guitar on several tracks and on vocals, vocal backup on this.
It was great working with him. Like they say, with recording, it's either really easy or it's impossible. And with him, it's easy.
So let's hear Last Leaf. This is from Tom Waits' new album, Bad Is Me, and it features Keith Richards on guitar and backup vocals.
When the autumn wind blows, they're already gone, fluttered to the ground cause they can't hang on. And there's nothing in the world that I ain't seen. I greet all the new ones that come in green. I'm the last leaf on the tree. And they all last say I've got staying power here on the tree. I've been here since Eisenhower, and I outlived even he. I'm the last leaf on the tree. The autumn took the rest, but they won't take me.
That's Tom Waits with Keith Richards singing backup from Tom Waits' new album, Bad as Me. How do you and Keith Richards even know each other?
Back in 84, 85, I don't know. New York, we were doing Rain Dogs, and my wife said, get Keith to play on this. I said, oh, God, no, I can't. I'm not worthy. She said, no, we get him. And it, one thing led to the other. And so, you know, he was called, and then I was mortified and embarrassed, and they sent him the record, and he liked it, and he came down with a semi-truck full of instruments and a musical butler, and, you know, it was really hilarious, and we played till very late, you know, and he played on like four or five songs. And so I've stayed in touch and know him since then. And nobody in the world like him. We wrote songs together for a while, and that was fun. I had never really written with anybody except my wife, so it was unique and a little scary at first, because he doesn't really remember anything or write anything down. So you play for an hour, and then he would yell across the room, "Scribe!" And I looked around, "Scribe? Who's the scribe?" And then he'd say it again, and now pointing at me, "Scribe!" And I was supposed to have written down everything we said and dreamt of and played. And I realized that we needed an adult in the room. And I've never been the one that one would consider the adult. So it was an interesting dynamic. I learned to be a scribe.
So there's another great ballad on your album called New Year's Eve. The song uses a line that you actually said in our previous interview. What you said in the previous interview was that sometimes you used to listen to two radios at the same time because you like hearing things incorrectly, and you got a lot of ideas by mishearing something. And in the song, you use the line, "All the noise was disturbing, and I couldn't find Irving. It was like two stations at the same time."
Yeah.
And I guess, is that an image you've been carrying around for many years, and it finally made its way into a song?
That happens. And so, yeah, I'm sure I've been carrying it around. The other line in there that I wanted to get into a song was, you know, you ever said to somebody, just keep talking, but don't use any names.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like two spies talking, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're talking about drugs, or you're talking about a woman, or you know. And I that's how the song kind of began, with just that line. And then we expanded it to a litany of trouble on New Year's. And then we all end up singing together in the middle of an evening filled with you know, a burnt sofa and a runaway dog and a broken window, and someone got arrested.
Well, let's hear New Year's Eve.
Okay.
Anything else you want to say about it before we hear it?
Yeah, well, it was 9 minutes long. And Kathleen said, you can't have a 9-minute song. They won't hang in there with you. You got to trim this down. Let's get rid of the gristle. Let's get this thing tighter. We argued about it. I said, I can't lose 5 verses. She says, you'll lose them. And I realized that I learned something from her, because I learned that, you know, if you can say it, you know, like they tell you when you're talking to your kids and you want to give them some advice, 21 words or less. So sometimes the same is true in a song. If you've already said it after 2 minutes, then get out. You know, so I'm learning.
Okay. Okay, well, this is New Year's Eve from Tom Waits' new album, Bad as Me.
It felt like 4 in the morning. What sounded like fireworks turned out to be just what it was. The stars looked like diamonds, and then came the sirens, and everyone started to curse. All the noise was disturbing, and I couldn't find on at the same time. And then I hid your car keys, and I made black coffee, and I dumped out the rest of the room. Nick and Socorro broke up.
That's New Year's Eve from Tom Waits' new album, Bad as Me. Back in the days when you were living in a hotel or living on the road,
yeah.
Did you ever imagine that one day you would be married for 30 years and the father of three?
No, I didn't. But I do remember disciplining imaginary children in the back seat of my car.
Why?
Hold your horses, Bill. It's enough out of you. I don't know why. Maybe I was anticipating their arrival, and I was rehearsing. I don't know, but I couldn't have seen that one coming. I don't know how much of our lives we can actually see coming.
So I just want to quote something that you told The Guardian, British newspaper, a few years ago in 2006. And you said when you stopped drinking, you wondered, am I genuinely eccentric or am I just wearing a funny hat? What am I made of? What's left when you drain the pool? So I think it was like many years ago that you gave up drinking. What did you learn about yourself when the alcohol wasn't there anymore?
I didn't know what to do with my hands.
Oh, like when you stopped smoking?
Yeah, I was smoking one hand and drinking the other. What did I learn? Boy, that's a big question, Terry. Yeah.
If it's too big, don't feel like you need to answer it.
I think it's probably like the what my wife said about the reality distortion field that I live in, which is kind of a place that you don't necessarily come back from. You know, maybe drugs and alcohol are more of a vacation from reality, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They say that life itself is really just the dead on vacation. Yeah.
Oh God, I hadn't heard that.
Isn't that terrible? I don't know. Am I just wearing a funny hat? Am I just trying to say weird stuff, or am I really peculiar and genuinely?
Did you want to be peculiar?
Well, I've always wanted to be curious and provocative, I guess, and interesting and interested in this kind of sparkling sapphire we all call home. You know? I've always wanted to be mystified by it all, and rather fascinated with life itself. And I don't know when I think maybe when you drink you're probably robbing yourself of that genuine experience, even though it appears that you're doing is getting more of it. You're getting less of it. And it takes a while when you've had a rock on the hose like that for so long. It takes a while for the hose to be a hose again, you know, and for things to start flowing. Like with songs, if you don't play for a while, if you stop playing for like even like a year, sometimes it all builds up in a really great way. That there's no such thing as not playing. You know, there's just, you know, music has rests in it. So you're on a rest right now, and the music will begin shortly. You know, it's like an orchestra tuning up. I used to try and get myself started. I would take a tape recorder and I would put it in the trash can, and the ones that are on wheels, you know, and I'd turn it on, and then I'd roll around in the yard with it and then play it back and see if I could hear any interesting rhythms, you know, that were just part of nature, you know. Or I tell you, the best snare drum on earth is a trampoline in like November, when all the branches have landed and they're heavy and they're wet. And when you jump on the trampoline, they all lift up and come down at the same time. It's like, wow.
Have you used those sounds on recordings?
I haven't, but I intend to.
It's great. It's like found sound.
Found sound, yeah.
So in terms of your life, do you feel like at this point in your life that you are like naturally eccentric and naturally interesting enough that no further artifice is required?
No more artifice. Well, there's always, you know, my wife thinks I'm a hoarder, you know, and I don't know. I collect things. It just occurred to me that I have a lot of National Geographics. And, you know, when they get wet, I mean, like, few have like 300 of them and they get wet, it could kill you, you know, if they're like above in an attic and they fall down. But now this is hoarder thinking. If you put those out in the sun, they'll dry. And then you can enjoy them again. You know, I have that kind of mentality. So I do accumulate things just naturally. And I can't stop doing it. Although I have seen the show Hoarders, and I know I'm not one. Because I don't think any hoarder thinks he's a hoarder.
That's right.
Right.
Well, one more song to close with from your new album.
Okay.
And this is Face to the Highway, another great song. Do you want to say anything about writing it?
Oh, God. All right. Well, I don't know. It's a road song. There's a lot of going away songs on the record. And this is definitely one of those. A theme doesn't really begin when you begin. It usually forms later. And now I look back on it, and Kathleen felt, too, that the songs have a lot of going away. Let's Go Get Lost, Chicago. So this is one of those.
Well, I like the line, I'm going to turn my face to the highway and turn my back on you.
Okay. Well, till we meet again, Terry.
Yes. Okay. It was so great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Good talking with you too, Terry. I'm going away, I'm going away, I'm going away, I'm going away. Cradle wants a baby, kitchen wants a pan, heart wants a certain kind of love if it can. The ocean wants a sailor, the gun wants a hand. Money wants a spender, and road wants a man. I'll turn my face to the highway. I'll turn my face to the highway. I'll turn my face to the highway. And I'll turn my back on you.
Face to the Highway is from the new Tom Waits album, Bad as Me. You can listen to more of Terry's interview with Tom Waits on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Glass wants a wine, fist wants a hand, clock wants a time, and the show.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Bill Nye, is a respected actor in British film, television, and theater, and he's become more familiar to American audiences in recent years. Nye has had roles in such films as Love Actually, The Constant Gardener, Notes on a Scandal, Pirates of the Caribbean, Shaun of the Dead, the TV movie The Girl in the Cafe, and the acclaimed British TV miniseries State of Play. In the new drama Page 8, which airs Sunday on the PBS Masterpiece series, Bill Nye plays a British intelligence officer who happens upon a document that could lead to an international scandal. Before we get to Nye's conversation with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, let's listen to a clip from Page 8. In this scene, Nye's character is talking to his daughter, an artist played by Felicity Jones. They're talking right after one of her openings. She wants to know what her father thinks about her latest artwork.
For once in your life, you might try telling me the truth.
Only if you insist.
I insist.
All right, they look like works of despair. If the despair isn't real, then I don't like them because they're fake, they're unfelt, they're avant-garde protest and nothing more. But if the despair is real, then that hurts too because you're my daughter and I don't want you to suffer.
They're not fake.
That's what I thought.
So what bothers you? If I'm unhappy, then it's your fault. They make you feel guilty, the absent father, the evasive father.
The pictures are morbid. They're morbid, Julianne. Okay, I can see it may be my problem to do with getting older, but why do you want to piss on life before you've even lived it?
I don't think you should say any more.
I was wondering.
Yeah.
That young man you were talking to.
Which one?
I think his name's Ralph. Ralph Wilson.
You're working. Hell, you're not even talking to me, you're working.
Oh, come on, let me take you home.
No. I don't want you anywhere near me. Do you have any honest relationships at all?
And that's our guest Bill Nye with Felicity Jones in the new film Page 8. I mean, you know, one of the reasons that I picked this clip was she says at the end to her father, your character, you're always working. And there's something about the mentality of a spy, somebody who is never off, always analyzing things from a dozen angles. I mean, how do you play somebody in that world?
Well, it's quite tricky because you are never wholly telling the truth. One of the difficulties about working in the intelligence services is that you can't even allow your family to know specifically about what you're involved in. And your children are amongst those who are excluded from knowing the facts of your working life. And the secrecy just goes on and on and on and kind of grows. And also, whenever you're speaking, you're only telling part of the truth. It makes it very satisfying as a part because it's quite it's complex and interesting.
We're speaking with Bill Nye. You might remember him from the films Love Actually and State of Play. His new film, which is going to be shown on PBS stations, is Page 8. You grew up in England. Your mom was a nurse and your dad managed a garage, right? And your home was on the premises, is that right?
Yeah, as you might say in America, I was born in a gas station. I wasn't actually born on the premises. I was born in a hospital. But we lived in a house where if you opened our front door, there were the gas pumps, the petrol pumps, as we call them. And my first ever job was serving petrol.
And you left school at an early age, is that right, and left the house at times?
I did. I ran away from home under the influence of Ernest Hemingway's short stories and Bob Dylan's first album. And I went to Paris in order to write the great English short story or something. Didn't write a word, but managed to flunk all my exams. I left school around, I think I was either 15 or 16, which wasn't that unusual in those days for the kind of people around our way. You weren't expected to have any further education, really, in those days. It's all a long time ago. So I did leave school pretty early, yeah.
So through the 70s and 80s, I mean, you developed a career, you got into television, you did some film, and I know that you developed a drinking problem, but you managed to keep working. I mean, did that hold you back at all, do you think, keep you from getting better?
I don't want to talk about this at length, but I will say a couple of things, and if you'll forgive me, I won't say anything further. One is that I didn't develop a drinking problem. I am one of those people who is built in such a way that I have from the very beginning an unfortunate relationship with alcohol. So there was never a good time for me to have a drink. And there's one further thing I will say, but I'd rather not say anything further just for reasons that we don't have to go into. It's not because I have any shame in this area. I'm a sober alcoholic. It's a perfectly respectable thing to be, and I've made arrangements about it. But I will say that I used to drink, and it was absolutely terrible. And now I don't drink, and it's absolutely marvelous. And that's as much as I'd like to say. Thanks.
I want to talk about Girl in the Cafe, a 2005 film that you starred in, written by Richard Curtis, directed by David Yates. One review said it's the best romantic comedy at a G8 summit you'll ever see. You play this very inhibited man, I guess in his 50s, who's kind of a high-ranking figure in the British finance office, the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
The civil service, yeah.
Right. And you meet this young woman, who is played by Kelly MacDonald, at a cafe. And you're this very inhibited fellow, and a relationship develops. And I thought we'd play a clip here fairly early in the film where you're taking a walk and getting acquainted, and you're outside. You'll hear some ambient noise. I think you're walking by a river. And I believe you're telling her about a dream.
Well, on the whole, in my dreams, people are begging me to join the Rolling Stones. I'm sitting at home, and the phone goes, and it's Mick Jagger and Ron Wood together on speakerphone, I suppose, pleading with me to inject a bit of new blood into the band. Or I'm at the office and they say, someone's waiting for you downstairs, and I get in the lift down and there's Keith Richards waiting on the sofa in the lobby, and he gives me his guitar and says, come on, man, you have the music, play. We'll give as much heroin as you like. Just lend us your hot legs.
And that's my guest, Bill Nye, playing the lead in the film Girl in the Cafe. This character, is just, if there's an opposite to the exuberant rocker that you play in Love Actually, it's this guy.
Yeah.
You want to talk about, I mean, there's a rhythm to his speech. How do you get this terribly inhibited guy?
Well, it's one of my favorite roles. It's something I absolutely understand. And also there is an element in it which reminds me of my father. My father was not unlike him in terms of he had a very uncertain kind of charm, but he wasn't overly sure of himself. He was a principled man, and he conducted himself impeccably and functioned very successfully in terms of his life. But he was undermined in a fundamental way.
And when you say undermined, you mean what?
I mean what they would probably currently call self-esteem problems, or they would call, you know, a basic kind of insecurity where your head sells you a negative idea of yourself. And you have to work out that if you're lucky, that anything negative that happens in your head is probably a lie. But it doesn't stop manufacturing this kind of negative propaganda, and you have to operate anyway.
I mean, were you undermined in that way? I mean, were you someone who's...
I had a whole kind of factory in my head, which with a lot of, negative propaganda machines working overtime. And I did have an anti-talent for describing myself negatively to myself.
Wow, not the kind of thing that you would think an actor would
bear. Be surprised, actually. I think you might be surprised. The people who are attracted to it often aren't the people you would imagine would be attracted to. They're not the gregarious ones. They're not the life and soul of the party. I know people who are household names who really have to put themselves through serious kind of discomfort in order to do their job. I know some great, great actors who... You know, they have no idea why they're... Sir Michael Gambon, who is in Page 8, is categorically a genius. I've seen him many times on stage and on film. He is one of that rare group who are, as they say, it's a cliche, but they are touched by genius. He doesn't know that. He doesn't want probably to hear me saying it. But he's not emboldened by that because he can't experience it. I can stand it, as I do often with Sir Michael, and I rarely use the, you know, you don't call people Sir this or Sir that. I mean, David Hare is Sir David Hare, but people don't. So with Sir Michael, I absolutely make a point of it, because I think of him as one of the leaders, if not the leader of my profession in England. And, you know, like me, you know, he has to persuade himself that he can be an actor, you know, every now and again as well.
Bill Nye speaking with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. You can see Bill Nye in the new made-for-TV movie Page 8 this Sunday on Masterpiece on PBS. And if you'd like to hear a longer version of Bill Nye's conversation with Dave Davies, you'll find that online at freshair.npr.org. After releasing the influential album Pet Sounds in 1966, the Beach Boys returned to the studio and filled hours of tapes with recordings intended for their next release. The album was to be called Smile, but it never saw the light of day. The tapes were put on the shelf, and Smile went down in history as one of the most famous unreleased albums of all time. In the years since the Smile sessions, bits and pieces of those recordings have found their way onto some of the Beach Boys' albums. Now, EMI has assembled a collection of highlights from the Smile sessions that were recorded in 1966 and 1967. Rock historian Ed Ward has listened to hours of them.
Okay, here we go. Sounds great. How about not hitting it, but kind of doing it with your hand?
Kind of shake it up a little. Think of your wife.
Real nice, real good. Here we go.
Enjoyed it.
Don't you wish your wife were here?
I did my chain with.
Yeah, well, I'm going to take my ring off before I ruin it.
That's part of the act.
That's part of the jewelry sound. Wait a second, Brian, so that I'm... Okay. You want to make it? One, two.
In the early days of High Fidelity, which I remember from childhood, the idea was that it was almost like being there when you listen to a record, something the old recordings never really delivered. The 6+ hours of the Smile Session highlights are certainly almost like being there, in the studio with the studio musicians, and occasionally the Beach Boys themselves, and Brian Wilson, trying to realize something he heard in his head. He never quite accomplished this, though. Not, as legend has it, because he was whacked out of his mind on LSD all the time and coming apart at the seams. No, music has the ability to get into your mind and make you hear things you want to accomplish. If you're an ultra-talented musician like Brian Wilson, you'll try, especially if your record company is willing to commit almost unlimited time and funds to your doing so. What he was doing was almost unheard of at the time. He called what he was doing feels, and later, and more accurately, modules. He'd record a musical module and then splice and mix it into the whole. But even so, he was frustrated. He may or may not have realized it at the time, but the technology for doing what he wanted didn't exist yet. Instead, he had to deal with the old standbys, recording tape, razor blades to cut it, and editing tape to stick one piece onto another. I've done it with very basic recordings. It's nerve-wracking.
Number 14.
One, two, three.
two excerpts from Heroes and Villains show finished versions of two modules that wound up in the final record. This song, which was released, was finished. Not all of the others were. There were several basic problems. First, Brian getting what he was hearing in his head onto tape. Second, there was incredible pressure to follow up a song which had emerged during the recording of their last album, Pet Sounds.
Good vibrations, take one.
We're rolling, let's go!
Good Vibrations took people by surprise and became the group's best-selling single ever. Brian used three different room sounds in three different studios and recorded modules in each of them over a six-month period between February and August 1966. The idea that Smile would be an album of that complexity had to cause stress. And then, there were business problems as the group transferred their own work to a label, Brother Records, they'd been given by Capitol. Capitol didn't like that and wanted a last album, Smile. Mike Love famously didn't like the lyrics either. Brian shelved the project in late 1967. So it wasn't a building near Gold Star Studios burning after Brian recorded the Mrs. O'Leary's Cow section that doomed Smile. It was simply that it was impossible, at least for the moment. Brian revisited the album in 2004 with another band, and that was used as the template for reconstructing this latest version. It's good to hear the original voices singing the music, but the five-disc session highlights is strictly for the fanatics. With its endless revision, studio chatter, and retakes, except for the disc on which we can hear Good Vibrations evolve, it's just like being there.
Rock historian Ed Ward lives in France. The Smile Sessions was released this week. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
How I love my girl.